Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law in North Carolina. Today is the last day of January 31st, 2013. Thanks so much for listening to these free, informative broadcasts. You can be part of this educational movement by telling your friends to listen to the show. Send them an email with a link. Actually, you could put it on your signature if you wish. Tweet it on Twitter, post the share button on Facebook, put it on the other social networks like Dig and StumbleUpon and Reddit. Copy the embed code once the show is finished. That will provide the archive, and you can put that directly onto your website or blog. Click that favorite button and become a regular listener. So we're thrilled to have Alan filling us in on the current events and lots of breaking news. There must be like 10 new articles this week alone from last week. So you can also go to pandemicresponseproject.com, Alan's website, and check out all the news and his other site, vaccinerights.com. How are you, Alan?
I am fine, Debbie. And yourself today?
I'm doing good. I love to see a clear blue sky and warm weather. I already planted some gloxinia or something yesterday, even though it's still January 31st. I mean, winter is not supposed to end until the end of March, but we're, you know, in global warming. And I just heard Al Gore talking to Diane Reams, and he's unbelievable what's happening with him. So, what do we have up for today's news in vaccine rights?
Boy, as you stated or implied there, as always, there's more going on than we have time to get to. I want to remind listeners that many of the news articles, probably most of the news articles we talk about on this weekly show, are articles that are linked from the Pandemic Response Project website's news page. That is Pandemic Response Project, those three words all spelled out, pandemicresponseproject.com. And there's a news link at the upper right-hand corner of every page. We never have time to get all the articles. We rarely have time to even do a full treatment of the ones we do talk about. But let's dive into here. I thought before I dove into news, though, Debbie, I get emails from time to time with people asking questions. And usually when one person asks a question, there are many people who are wondering if you don't get around to actually calling or emailing. I thought I would pick one of those in case I don't get to any further ones later in the show. But this comes from a pediatric chiropractor in California. He asks, can a parent opt out of selected vaccines using a philosophical or religious exemption, or is it an all or nothing proposition? And the reason that I think this is such a good question is that it doesn't necessarily have a clear answer. You know, hypothetically, I guess hypothetically is the word, the law ideally would present rules in language that would cover any hypothetical future situation. And as a practical matter, of course, it's just impossible for the law to do that. So sometimes when you have a particular question, there is a very clear answer in the law. Other times there isn't. And when people talk about religious and philosophical exemptions, they're usually referring to state school exemptions, and those particular laws vary from state to state. But the starting place for how does my state's law work, or what does it cover or not cover or allow or not allow, the starting place is the language of the law. And every state has what they call statutory construction laws or rules, which is just a phrase or label that refers to rules that tell a state how to interpret statutes. And the several states whose statutory construction rules I have looked at all have one version or another of a rule. It's usually in two steps, that where they say that you're supposed to interpret statutes, first of all, to give the intent of the legislature. That seems sort of a common sense concept. You don't want to, you know, the legislature enacts a law, they have some intent with that law, presumably expressed by the wording of the law, the language, and we don't want to interpret laws to be contrary to the legislative intent. Well, when a law is unambiguous, that is, when its plain English meaning is clear on its face by the words it's used, then that is usually presumed to be stating the legislative intent. So this is kind of a long-winded way of saying a clear law means exactly what it says, nothing more, nothing less. And so when we look at the wording of exemption laws, it's often not clear whether you can do some under a philosophical or religious exemption, or is it an all-or-nothing proposition. But I will say that as a general rule, I think religious exemptions do generally contemplate all or nothing. There's some very clear exceptions. Colorado, for example, has a form where they list all the vaccines, and you check a little box by each vaccine, that whatever, either whichever ones you're getting or claiming the exemption from.
Which state does that?
Colorado.
Colorado gives you a choice of selecting the vaccines?
Selecting what vaccines you're going to get and what vaccines you're not going to get. Now, they may not be the only state that does that, but they're the only one I'm aware of off the top of my head. But the health department form allows you to pick and choose under either philosophical or religious basis.
How did that Colorado is very liberal. Is it not in that way? I mean, it would be great if all of the states had that.
Well, they all should. You know, if we're going to be allow parents to make their constitutionally granted, if we're going to allow parents to have and exercise fully the decision-making authority over medical decisions that the Constitution and the U.S. Supreme Court says parents have, then there ought to be, you know, I had never thought of the argument in the way I'm expressing it right now until this very moment. There ought to be there arguably should be the option for philosophical or religious reasons for parents in every state to choose or opt out of vaccines. See, under the Constitution, parents are presumed to be fit and capable of making decisions for their children and in the best interest of their children, unless there's some sort of process, adjudication process, some kind of a formal proceeding where evidence is presented to show that a particular parent is not fit. But we are presumed under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to be fit parents. And according to the Supreme Court, parents have the authority and the responsibility of making medical decisions for their children. So it's sort of interesting. There's a potential constitutional argument that every state should have a philosophical exemption in that basis, that parents are presumed to be making decisions in the best interest of their children unless it's shown otherwise. But I don't know. Perhaps that would be overruled, so to speak, by health department's assessment that vaccines are necessary. In any event, unless the law clearly says you can pick and choose, such as the form in Colorado, I think it's a risk to make that assumption, whether it's religious or philosophical exemption, because if you step out and do some vaccines but not all, and someone challenges that formally, if it's not clear one way or the other in the law, there's no telling. Or if the law doesn't clearly give you that option, there's no telling how a judge would interpret the law, whether that would be in your favor or not. Could potentially undermine the exemption. So there certainly are some potential arguments, and it may vary from state to state depending on the specific wording of each state's laws. But it's a perfectly valid idea, for example, to interpret a religious exemption law as allowing you to reject only those, and this is just one example, only those vaccines whose development involved the use of aborted fetal tissue, because that's something that's widely recognized as an issue that is a deeply religious issue for a lot of people, the abortion issue. So, and there is at least one case I'm aware of out in New York that went to the first level of adjudication through an administrative proceeding, and the mother was able to refuse only those vaccines whose development involved the use of aborted fetal tissue, and she was okay with the other vaccines. So it's a possible, it's a plausible argument, I'll put it like that, but there's no real guarantee how a court would interpret it if it's not, if the language is not clear on its face, and so it's a risk when people interpret those laws. But I tell you, I'm just speculating, Debbie, but I want to comment about what I think might be behind the Colorado's choice, or at least an implication of the choice they made to give parents that option, either on philosophical or religious grounds, to pick and choose vaccines. And I think the pro-vaccine side, the state health department and doctors who favor vaccines, might prefer that parents do some vaccines rather than no vaccines, and exercising sort of an all-or-nothing choice and the nothing choice in terms of an exemption. And on the flip side of the issue, I could see the pro-exemption parents feeling like they'd rather parents do some vaccines than all vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems to me a really suitable compromise, frankly, between the two sides. But one that, from my point of view, is a very positive one, in that it allows parents to make an informed choice, and they will educate themselves to whatever extent they do and make whatever choice they make accordingly. But they have that choice there. Now, this is all
well,
kind
it,
of goes
well, it seems like by providing the checklist, it gives the parent, who's the guardian and the choice maker, to select the range from all or none or any variety in between. So it's really giving freedom of choice.
Yes, yes, it is. And I think ultimately that's the place we need to get to in our society with regard to vaccines and any and all medical treatment. I mean, we should be able to make the choice. Now, this is only a step towards achieving full freedom of right to choose, because, as I mentioned in the past, most states have laws where if the state declares an emergency and mandates an emergency vaccine, then those exemption options go out the window. So there's another layer, if you will, to the issue here. But a really good question, and not always a really clear answer as to whether or not you can pick and choose. But I think if the option is not clearly available in the wording of a law, in a health department regulation or form, then I think parents who do the some but not all option under a religious or philosophical exemption potentially put themselves at risk. It may be that it's common practice in some states, like perhaps California. It's, you know, based on the wording of the law, you can refuse vaccines for personal belief. It might be a reasonable interpretation of that phrase or their law to say you could do some but not all. But unless there's some clear precedent somewhere, precedent in the law or policy in the health department or something like that, I think it'd be risky. If you're not sure in your state, you could contact a state health department and say, what is their policy regarding the interpretation of the exemption law? Does the health department support an interpretation of some but not all under your state's laws? That would be a very reasonable step to take, because if the health department supports it, and that's the position you want to do personally, you're on much more solid ground. See if you can get it in writing from them, just so you have something, you know, to point to should it ever become an issue. But I would check with the health department if I were looking at that issue. But let's dive on in, because as always, there's more articles here to talk about than there is time to talk about. Debbie, I want to take us to an article first that is sort of a macro view issue that I think includes vaccine issue, but is not itself directly on the vaccine issue, because I found this very, very troubling. You know, I have talked over and over again on this show, and will continue to do so in all my shows, about the legislative trends, how within and without, frankly, the vaccine issue, that in recent years here in the U.S., we see laws being passed that are restricting our liberties, our freedom of choice. And in particular with vaccines, there are at least 5 states that passed laws just in the last 2 years making it harder for parents to exercise exemptions for their kids in schools. And in at least 3 or more instances, laws that on their face, the wording of the law, in my opinion, is unconstitutional. But the goal of those seeking to restrict access to exemptions is one that apparently doesn't care about constitutional rights and boundaries. It's they're going to do whatever they can to achieve their goal, including overstepping legal boundaries. And it's not like this is the only arena or time in history that that's ever happened. I'm sure it's something that happens from time to time. But here, in particular, it happens despite, in some instances, legislators or governors being informed that there's a constitutional issue here. And I reported a few months ago that we had sent, I had sent to the governor of Washington State by way of some activists there, a paper explaining formally why the bill, proposed bill, was unconstitutional, and the governor's office's response to that was, well, that's not our concern, that's up to the courts, which technically is true, but basically a very shallow and disingenuous excuse to sign a bad bill into law. And this is the way politics works, apparently, in our country today. It's very disconcerting.
Of course, it's more like vaccines are pass the buck over to the next person or the next group that has authority. You know, don't blame me. In other words, this is something that I'm able to do, but it's not completely under my jurisdiction. Is that kind of what's happening?
I think you're giving way too much benefit of the doubt there. I think the real underlying message is, you know, your argument is not consistent with my agenda, my political agenda, so we're going to ignore you, and we're going to find an excuse that, you know, to let us do that. But, I mean, it's, to me, that's no more valid than saying we're adding more vaccines to the schedule so that we can protect children even better. You know, that's just a scientifically false assertion that's purely veneer. You know, the agenda is already decided. The goal and the steps is already decided. They will add a veneer to it to try to smooth it over, but it's not something – they were not open to discussion on it. They'd already made up their mind. We're going to pass this bill in the governor's office. We're going to sign this into law because the pharmaceutical industry is pressuring us to do that, and they, you know, have all the money or whatever it is. You know, that's certainly part of it, I'm sure, at least. But whatever it is that's actually and ultimately driving it, it's not an agenda that is open for discussion. It's like when I talk about how I sat down with my state representative to say that there's a certain law here in North Carolina that is egregiously unconstitutional, needs to be fixed, and she says to me, well, I can't help you, UNC Hospitals is in our district. Just totally blowing over or pushing aside the fact that she had taken an oath to uphold state and federal constitutions, that it's her moral and ethical duty and her job as a legislator when presented with something as unconstitutional to fix it. And what she basically said was, that's not how the system works. The system doesn't work the way it pretends to work. That's not how it really works. Our oath doesn't really mean anything. That's just a lie that we say so we can get in and do the politics that we want to do, that we can serve the special interests and private interests, because that's why legislators go to the state legislature or to Congress at the federal level, so that they can further the goals of private interests and special interests and profit handsomely themselves in the process. They're not there to help the people. Now, I can't say that they never do help the people or never do anything, but even any honest attempt is so infiltrated and skewed by the pressure, money, power, and control of private and special interests. The system is fully corrupt. And this leads me to the article I want to talk about here. The title of the article, West Point, this comes from a website called activistpost.com. West Point defines domestic enemies to prepare troops to take on Americans. Now, the article starts out, and I'm going to tie this into vaccines, so bear with me here, at least indirectly. The article starts out talking about how soldiers and police in America, they take an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. But the question that this article raises is, how do we know what a domestic enemy of the Constitution is? And a study apparently recently published by the West Point Combating Terrorism Center, and this study is titled Challengers from the Sidelines, Understanding America's Violent Far Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the study author, Ari Perlinger, I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation or not.
Ari Perlinger, sounds right.
So I'm going to go with that and just apologize to Ari if I'm saying any part of his name incorrectly.
Ari means lion. That's what it means. I'm taking a chance. That's what it means in Hebrew.
Okay. Well, the study attempts to present a picture of an America infested with dangerous right-wing domestic terrorists lurking in the shadows and waiting to launch an attack on government establishments, agents, and minorities, and so forth. Now, there may be aspects and elements of truth to this, but what concerns me, when I want to get to, without spending too much of the show time on this, because there are other articles I want to get to here to discuss at least briefly, but they take a large, broad sweep in terms of terms and language and definition and many different categories and sort of lump them all into one. Here are the domestic terrorists. And they range from ordinary militias, anti-abortion activists, libertarians, and anarchists, and quote-unquote conspiracy theorists. So he suggests what he calls a far-right contingent. He says this is glued together by an identification with an anti-federalist ideology and a belief in a new world order. Now, the next phrase here is I think, the most critical one. These groups are concerned with the, quote, corrupted and tyrannical nature of the federal government and its apparent tendency to violate individuals' civilian liberties and constitutional rights. I want to read this again because, Debbie, this is a phrase that clearly includes this show, and this is where I'm driving at with this.
Okay.
Groups that are concerned with the corrupted and tyrannical nature of the federal government and its apparent tendency to violate individuals' civilian liberties and constitutional rights. Now, I just took a couple of minutes repeating something I've said over and over here about how the government is passing unconstitutional, state governments passing unconstitutional laws with regard to vaccines. And here is somebody who is lumping me into a category of what they call the violent far right.
Really?
And I find this very disturbing because I am concerned with the corrupted and tyrannical nature of the federal government and its apparent uh-huh. tendency to violate individuals' civilian liberties and constitutional rights. We talk about those kinds of ideas all the time here. Now, I just want to be really clear that I do not, nor have I ever, nor do I think I will ever advocate anything even in the general direction of violence, let alone any literal or actual violent behavior. I quite
You're
the
a peacenik. You're peaceful.
Peaceful, I don't
you're
own a gun.
Peaceful,
I've never
peaceful
owned a gun.
Nonviolence
I don't want to own a gun,
Gandhi
you know.
Follower.
Yeah, I mean, I'm much more in the direction of a Gandhi than I am an armed terrorist.
So is this inciting some sort of a response from a certain group of people, or inciting hateful?
Well, the point here is that they're saying the article is saying West Point. And West Point, the students who attend West Point are being trained to be the commanding officers in our military, and these people are being given a definition of domestic terrorist that is so broad and so sweeping in its language as to include anybody who refers to, for example, New World Order, or anybody who basically complains or suggests that there's any problem with the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I mean, clearly there is widespread and well-documented. This is not conspiracy theory stuff. This is documented. You know, we talk about things on in the rare instances on this show where we talk about theoretical or hypothetical or speculative matters, we do a really good job of qualifying it. But when we assert something as fact, it's something that we have good, clear, supporting, documented information backing it up. And there's a lot of well-documented information about the corruption in the federal government, and we talk about the corruption in the FDA and CDC in particular a lot on this show, although we've mentioned documented corruption elsewhere as well in the federal government. And
if you can read it in the New York Times or the LA Times or any other major news organization, then it's there for the public to read and learn about and investigate on their own. And hopefully they are not, you know, sometimes the media does just push out a headline and they're not really, they have to make corrections. But typically there's some sort of fact behind what they're printing.
Well, a lot of the information we talk about you don't find on the mainstream news for the simple reason that the pharmaceutical industry is an enormous purchaser of advertising time in the mainstream media, and those businesses and companies are not going to put out much, if anything, that's negative about the pharmaceutical industry or its goals and agendas, because they would stand to lose significant amounts of money, advertising revenue, for doing so. Now, there may be levels and aspects of control that go way beyond that, but we don't have to go any further than just that sort of superficial surface financial relationship between advertiser and programming to know that the mainstream media is not about to allow anything negative about the pharmaceutical industry to go out in the mainstream news. So we do talk about a lot of information. Sometimes it is out there in the mainstream news, but probably more often than not, from the so-called alternative media, but and I'm sure we're not right 100% of the time. I mean, who is? But we do take painstaking efforts to document the assertions we make before asserting them. So it's not like we're out in some creative, inventive way, you know, fanning false flames to try and stir people up, and certainly not to anything that would be violence-related at all. But it really concerns me that, you know, the idea of freedom of speech is so broad and fundamental and for the most part something we take for granted. You know, if you want to go on the radio or in an article or any other public forum and talk about your belief in the New World Order, that's your God-given and Constitution-given right. And for somebody to say that to frame in an article about domestic terrorism that it's going to include people who have a belief in a new world order is such a blatant and unconstitutional threat I read it as a threat that anybody who dares to suggest a New World Order theory or belief is now falling under an umbrella that they could begin to be looked at as a terrorist. And President Obama just signed into law a law that allows anybody who's a suspected terrorist, even if it's an American on American soil, to be detained indefinitely in a secret location without access to the courts or an attorney or anything else. You know, normally
when a law
is... Does that include
you?
Well, this is the concern I'm raising. It could potentially include any of us if they're going to define terrorism so broadly as anybody who thinks the government is corrupt and says so is a potential terrorist suspect. So I'm putting this out not because I want to scare people or make people paranoid, but because I think it's important for us to keep our eyes open and watch where this country is going and watch the way things are playing out. And to recognize...
Bring together the way you opened the show and at this point in the show, how laws are written to be not vague, but can be interpreted in many ways and open for interpretation, whereas that's for the positive. You know, giving people freedom, you want to give as much freedom as possible. But when it comes to defining somebody and giving a label that they're a terrorist, in this case, we have to have specifics and make it absolutely clear and not open to interpretation. Is that correct thinking or not? Are you with me?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm real clear on the question, but let me give partial answer.
Here you're saying that they're talking, you said Obama just signed into a bill that any suspect can be detained based on, I don't know, the potential.
Based on them being a suspected terrorist. Well, how do we know if somebody's a suspected terrorist? Well, that depends on how the term is defined.
Exactly.
And what I'm saying is, laws are passed to achieve an agenda, whether it's a good law that, you know, serves the public or a bad law that's perhaps covertly but nonetheless serving a private or public agenda that should never have been passed. But regardless, you know, laws are passed to serve an agenda. I don't know what the agenda is when you're saying that any American can be detained if they're a terrorist suspect. Without access to the courts or hearing or anything else, that's blatantly unconstitutional. So what is the agenda for passing such a law? What is the incentive for anybody to vote for something like that that is so obviously and blatantly in violation of the most fundamental due process rights that our Constitution was created to drafted to create and protect, something that people in prior times and countries rights they should have had but didn't have. And so our country was founded in large part to create and preserve rights that people should have had all along but didn't have. Well, we're having those rights be taken away from us, and I think we should be very, very concerned about that. I don't know what the agenda is.
Who would be the person to define what is the definition of a terrorist?
Well, we'd have to look at the law itself, because the statutes will often include a section of just definitions to see how they define terms. And I must confess that I have not yet gone to the federal statutes to see how they define terrorism or terrorist, and that's a really good point. But for purposes of the article here about West Point,
right,
our nation's future military leaders are being given information about what a domestic terrorist is that is disturbingly broad. And I have read, and I don't have information confirming this because it's not something I've had or taken time to look further into, but I have seen information very recently saying that Obama has a litmus test for top military people. Would you be willing, if push came to shove, to fire on Americans?
Is that one of the questions?
And, well, according to the information, that's the litmus test. It was a phrase, you know, figure of speech used, that if you're not willing to fire on Americans, you're not going to be part of Obama's second term military leadership. Now, I don't have information showing validating that or disputing that, so I'll put that out there for people to consider. I'm not asserting it as a fact. I mean, I'm very careful to qualify information when I don't have validation on it. But if that's true, and it's consistent with what this article is talking about, I mean, it looks there are a lot of things rolling out and playing out rapidly in currently and in recent months, very recent years, in the country on the vaccine issue and other issues that potentially point in a very disturbing direction. If the definition of terrorism for America's up-and-coming military leaders is so broad that somebody who believes in a new world order is potentially...
I just lost your sound. Hello, is anybody out there? I think I just had a brownout, and I'm not sure if there's any sound. So we had a little bit of white space there, and I'll see if Alan is still with us. And in the meantime, I will go ahead and talk about, if anybody can hear me, let me know. There was just an article put out here that the first genetically engineered flu vaccine is now on the market. And I'm going to see, despite evidence to the contrary, the conventional view is that getting inoculated is the best way to protect yourself against the flu. And as we know, hello, Alan, are you back with me?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we had kind of like a short, a brownout. I don't know whether it was your end or my end. But I guess the military is tuning into our show. And
I want to tell you, Deb, as soon as I was disconnected, I dialed right back in. I hit 1, which is how you get in when you dial the guest call-in number.
Yeah.
And I got a recording of America the Beautiful or something playing. It was almost like just total sarcasm, like someone had cut me off and was just, you know, not going to let me back in. So
sure.
I don't know what in the world that was about. But and I don't know exactly where I got cut off there.
I went ahead to the next item up for bids.
Where are we at here then?
First genetically engineered flu vaccine now on the market. You know, they've been developing that for a long time, and everything is getting genetically modified or engineered. And as I was telling you, I did listen to a bit of the Diane Reen show with Al Gore this morning, and he is gung-ho about genetic engineering, it seems to me, because he was talking about these orb spiders that produce something in their web that is useful. And he says, you know, we can't really make spider farms, because they're just not cooperative animals, insects. So instead, they took the genetics from the spider and they injected it into sheep or goats or something, and then that chemical came out in their milk, and now you're harvesting their milk to use to get this material. And, you know, supposedly it's something that's positive and useful that we can use, but I really have my doubts about playing God and creating all of these unusual species, because we don't know.
Yeah, the problem with genetic engineering in general is that it's such new and novel territory that we just have no way of knowing or predicting what the potential side effects or adverse events or whatever you want to call it.
Down the line, what's going to happen?
Yeah, and of course, anytime you're dealing with something out in the open like genetically modified crops, there's the potential, and with that example in particular, we've already now seen this, where something gets out into the natural environment and where you can no longer regulate or manage or control it. So then we as a...
You know, it's interesting. They're using these insects. I cut you off there. Is that okay? Do you want to finish?
Well, I was just going to say, then we as a local area or region or even country or world are stuck with the effects of that, negative or positive. Once it's out in the environment, you can't call it back in. And that's the part that's really disturbing to me. And we're finding, you know, the nature of agribusiness is that it seeks to serve its own profit-based motives. And it's not going to slow that down by putting any thing like common sense in the way and protection of people in the way of profits. Profits always come first. And so they will, as has been demonstrated quite clearly in the GMO issue as it pertains to crops, hide, suppress, cover up, deny adverse effects so they can go forward with pursuing their profit control agenda. And then we end up finding out later that there really are serious adverse events from the routine consumption of genetically modified plants, for example. Cause organ damage and other things. But, you know, once you've gone down that path as a business, it's real hard to apparently anyway, in practice, to stop or turn around and go back.
Right. So in the past, the speed of things was a little bit slower, and you could, like even with any kind of the drugs, they just do a recall. They do a recall, and they don't give it out, and they tell people to stop taking it. And yes, people have been hurt, and people have died and injured from this kind of thing. But once it's taken off the market, then it's no longer there. But in the case of GMOs, they become part of nature and integrated into it in such a way that we don't know the lasting effects and how it's changing all of us genetically. But I find it interesting that this Flublok, FLUBLOK, is produced by programming insect cells to produce hemagglutinin, a flu virus protein essential for the entry of the virus into your body's cells. And so it seems as if utilizing insects is the way that they're doing so many of these new processes. And I'm thinking about, you know, insects are prolific around our globe. There are so many of them, and they're the ones who are, they inject us with their venom, with their stings, and now we're utilizing that to inject ourselves. I just find it fascinating as a thought, and that is hypothetically, you know, I'm fantasizing about what's actually happening.
Well, you know, Dr. Mayor Eisenstein had a real interesting comment on this vaccine the other night on the Know Your Rights Hour. He was suggesting that one goal of this particular vaccine and development of it is to get past the allergy reason. A lot of people say they can't get a flu vaccine because they have an egg allergy, for example.
Right.
And they're cultured in eggs, I guess. Now those people won't have that excuse with this vaccine.
Uh-huh.
Because it's cultured in a different way. So he was sort of cynical in that respect, saying this is, in part at least, he's speculating with saying this is the way to get past that. But I have seen, you know, with healthcare workers anyway, the hospitals have been on a trend to tighten up their restrictions or become more restrictive in terms of what they will allow with medical exemptions. And I've known hospitals where one year they would allow somebody to be exempt from the flu shot because of an egg allergy. The next year they'd say, nope, that's not an excuse anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
What changed?
They didn't have enough immunizations. I didn't have enough people immunized. They wanted to increase the immunization rate. I mean, that's what it all boils down to on that level. If they make a change, it's because they want a higher immunization rate. It's in one sense, it's really that simple. Now, I'm being cynical when I say that, but this is not unfounded by any stretch of the imagination. the standard that they're going to that I saw this past fall, and I had a lot of nurses and other healthcare workers call me and say, hey, they accepted my medical exemption last year, but they're rejecting it this year. And that's why they ended up on the phone with me this year. But I say this year, I mean this past fall. But the standard they're going to is anaphylactic shock, history of anaphylactic shock from a vaccine, or Guillain-Barré syndrome within 6 weeks of a vaccine. And if you don't fall into either of those two categories, they're going to say no. I had one nurse who had letters from three different doctors saying from three different specialty perspectives, you know, this person should not get a flu shot. And the hospital said, we don't care. You don't fall into our narrow parameters here. And those parameters are out there somewhere officially. I don't know if that's a CDC recommendation or some other recommendation, but there's some source for it. And
So what did you do in a case like that? I mean, so that the medical exemption did not work for that woman?
Well, so we took a look at coming in under federal civil rights law within the very broad, if tricky, arena of religious beliefs and religious objections. You know, the under federal civil rights law, employees can ask, and employers are required to accommodate their employees' religious beliefs and practices. I'll say qualifying employers. I think it's employers with 15 or more employees, something on that order. So it doesn't. The point is, it doesn't apply to every employer in the country, absolutely, but certainly any, most, if not all, of any significant size, certain size or greater. But there's even a narrow category of beliefs you could hold as an atheist that are protected religious beliefs under federal civil rights law, but there are also some real tricky areas, what I call legal pitfalls, that people tend to fall into when they approach it on their own. So it's broad in terms of who can potentially qualify, but it's tricky in terms of specific beliefs. ABC News ran an article recently, and I was really glad they did this, talking about Indiana nurses who had been fired for refusing the flu shot, and they called me, interviewed me, and talked, you know, quoted me in the article. They misquoted me. I want to take a real quick minute just to underscore this.
I think
this.
We
I'm
did not, this last year. You,
did
last
we do this last week?
Last week.
All right.
You want to talk about it again?
Yeah, just real briefly, because
okay.
I'm concerned, because it's misleading. And they quoted me as saying that federal law is so broad that, you know, any sincerely held belief would qualify, and just having an objection to the flu vaccine should suffice, you know, something to that effect. And I just want to clarify to folks that that is not what I said. And while I mean no offense to the journalist who interviewed me and wrote the article, I'm sure it was unintentional on her part.
Shouldn't they have a retraction or a correction somewhere?
Well, once it's out there, it's out there. You can't really unring the bell. You know, they can go back and correct things, but it's out there, and it's, you know, you follow up later and say, oops, here's a correction, or you correct it or whatever, and it's sort of like, you know, we're in the damage control, or I'm in the damage control phase now. But it's absolutely not any sincerely held belief, and not just a sincere objection to the flu vaccine. It has to be one that is religious in nature, as the law defines that. And that's the answer to how does the law define that is a consultation. It's not a short answer question. But I just want to reinforce for healthcare workers in particular, but in any employees, because we're going to see flu vaccines mandated ultimately for all employees in the U.S., unless enough of us who object to that take the necessary steps to get laws in place that prevent it. And interestingly enough, one of the articles I wanted to briefly mention today, Debbie, is one talking about how Oregon hospitals have, compared to the rest of the nation, really low vaccination rates of their employees, because according to this article, they're the only state in the country that has a law that prevents hospitals from mandating the flu vaccine for their employees. This is very telling, because the goal here, and it's not a covert agenda here, it's an explicit one, is to vaccinate the Department of Health and Human Services Healthy People 2020 initiative has a stated goal to vaccinate 90% of healthcare workers. They want to get the healthcare workers vaccinated. That then is going to be the model they hold up to the rest of the country. Look, all of your healthcare professionals are vaccinated. You need to get the vaccine just like them. What they're not going to say is we had to make them do it, or they wouldn't have done it. And the hospitals in Oregon are a real interesting example, because while there certainly is a lot of recent high-pressure propaganda to try and convince those employees to get the flu vaccine, and that probably has helped to increase vaccine rates to one degree or another, they still have substantially lower vaccination rates. Now, the numbers they
lower
give...
Lower than what?
Lower than hospitals in other states where either by state law or hospital policy the flu shots are mandated. You know, we're just talking about how wonderful Colorado was with their school exemption.
Yeah.
Well, Colorado also has a law requiring healthcare workers to be vaccinated, and there's no exemption, no religious exemption in state law for healthcare workers like there is for students.
For healthcare workers only.
Right. Healthcare workers in Colorado can still object on religious grounds under federal civil rights law. But like hospitals around the rest of the country, this is an education process because the hospitals don't know about that and they're not bothering to go look it up. So, you know, a big part of my work this fall working with healthcare workers around the country was educating hospitals about the federal civil rights law, trying to get them to get their own attorneys involved, because if they would have just gone to their own attorneys in the first place, my job and my clients achieving their exemption goals would have been a lot easier. Most of the time.
Okay, so what else did you want to say about this Oregon situation? The hospitals is this Massachusetts healthcare bill bans mandatory overtime for nurses and limits spending to, no, that's a different one.
This one is Ashland Hospital, which is an Oregon hospital.
Ashland
Hospital workers lag in getting their flu shots. 69% of hospital workers got them statewide last year compared with 50%.
Okay.
For here, and they give different figures depending on who you count. Do you count everyone who comes through the door or, you know, physicians with privileges, for example, who aren't on the hospital's payroll directly or, you know, who do you count? So depending on who you count, they have anywhere from, I think it was 34% to maybe 60-something percent or whatever. But anyway, they said 34% of the 830 people who have the authority to walk through this Ashland hospital halls, as I said, received a flu shot last season. So that's a pretty small percentage. You know, the states that mandated and the individual hospitals and systems around the country that mandated, they're aiming for 90% because, at least according to one hospital attorney I talked to in recent weeks, at some point they're going to be losing up to 2% of Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement if they don't have 90% of their employees vaccinated. So this is a real interesting situation here. Also in Oregon right now, we have a bill that, if passed, would both expand access to state school exemptions and add steps to getting the exemption that would have complicated. Of course, the end goal is to reduce exemptions. But Oregon is one of a handful of states that presently has an unconstitutional religious exemption statute in that it requires membership in an organized religion.
Really?
There still are states that do that, despite the fact that that kind of law has been challenged at least 5 times in state or federal courts around the country in the past, and it's always been held to be unconstitutional.
What is it about Oregon? Is there something about that state that's different from the other states?
Well, my guess, and I haven't researched this, so it's an educated guess, but when exemption laws were first being enacted, they were contemplating religious sects that oppose medical treatment, you know, like the Amish or Christian Scientists or Jehovah's Witnesses. And so they probably drafted their laws accordingly, and what they were really trying to say without naming actual religious sects was that, you know, if you're one of these obscure groups that opposes all medical care, then you don't have to get the vaccine. But those kinds of laws, when they've been challenged in state and federal courts over the years, have been held to be unconstitutional because our First Amendment's free exercise of religion right is not restricted to people who are members of an organized religion. It applies to anybody who has a sincerely held belief that is religious in nature. And that's much broader than requiring that that one be tied to an organized religion. So I think it's just kind of a legacy thing that many of these laws, they were probably quite common around the country when they were first enacted, but some have changed on their own, and others have changed when they've been challenged and held to be unconstitutional in court. But there just are several states that have yet to get around to fixing or changing those laws because nobody has taken the effort to make it happen.
So the law has to be challenged by someone in order to make this change in that particular state.
Well, you either get the state legislature to amend the law, you know, to fix the problem, or you could potentially go through the proper steps to get it into court and have a judge declare the law to be unconstitutional. But ultimately, I think most of the time it's going to require some kind of legislative change, whether it starts with a legislature or starts with a court. So we'll see. You know, the way it plays out depends on the individual state laws and procedures and so forth. And so it's a state-by-state kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see what happens. But the law, the bill, as it's drafted right now in Oregon, would allow parents to opt out without having to specify whether or not it's a religious objection. It doesn't even use the word religion anymore, so what it does is really open the door for philosophical objections. But there's an educational component, just like we saw in Washington State's recent law and California's new law when it takes full effect, I think, next year, where you'll have to get, you know, a lecture from a doctor. I think the Oregon law was even language talking about going through some sort of educational thing on the internet, so you might not necessarily have to go pay a doctor to get your, you know, your verbal beating for daring to put yourself and everyone at risk for getting an exemption. Of course, those quote-unquote educational, you know, hoops you have to jump through are intended to talk you out of the exemption. But, and again, as it pertains to those people who would be opting out on religious grounds, to throw in other requirements beyond what the federal courts have said is required for religious exemption, it would be unconstitutionally restrictive. So I think the bill, as it's drafted, is arguably unconstitutional. But it's an interesting mix because on the one hand, it opens it up to any religious belief and philosophical exemptions, which is a great improvement over the current religious exemption law. But it also throws in this educational component, which is a downside. I mean, if you're going to opt out of vaccines for religious or philosophical reasons, the scientific merits are really, for many of those people anyway, are beside the point. You know, the philosophical point, as an example, the philosophical point that, well, it's an established medical and legal fact that vaccines injure and kill people, and while there's disagreement about the risk of that, nobody can tell you whether you or your child are going to be the next injury or death from a vaccine. And that raises a philosophical issue that is separate and apart from any medical aspect of the issue. Should I or my child be required to take that risk for the presumed benefit that others will have by, you know, me or my child being protected? That is a philosophical question that does not have a quantifiable answer. And, of course, if people are objecting on religious grounds, it's about God and faith in God or whatever the particular religious beliefs are, but those are separate and apart, if not outright mutually exclusive from the medical and scientific concerns. So to have to go through an educational process for a philosophical or religious exemption just doesn't even make sense from a common sense point of view. But, again, the goals here are political. They're not rational. They're not scientifically based goals. They're not reasonable in terms of the law and rights. They are politically motivated goals, the political goal being specifically to maximize immunization rates. Too many people out there, you know, reading all that information on the internet and trying to get out of vaccines. We can't let that happen. You know, that'll be profits going down. And if vaccine use goes down, then chronic disease rates will go down, and we don't want to lose that market either. So it's an insidious market-based agenda, one that's controlled by industry and not through a proper use of the legislative and political systems, which are really initially designed and intended to serve the public, not industry.
Okay. Did you have any other article that you wanted to cover today for sure?
Well, I tell you what, I know we're just about out of time here, but I'll mention real briefly, we talked about an article in the past about some African children who suffered, in some cases, severe paralysis after getting a new meningitis vaccine. Well, the let me see if I can pull this back up here. It's in Africa where this took place.
Go ahead.
The African government is now claiming that it's all in their head, or it's not the vaccine. There was at least one child who had the same symptoms who didn't get a vaccine, and so forth. And people who have investigated this have been told that was a lie that was made up to try and, you know, hide or cover up the problem. You know, initially there was no dispute about the vaccines being connected with the paralysis, but now we're seeing the after-the-fact spin and rewriting of reality, which unfortunately is not uncommon in today's world, to try and protect the vaccine industry and governments who are the partners in collusion with the vaccine industry. But it's just really sort of disturbing. I mean, just the headline to this article as a follow-up to the original reporting of this problem: African children still paralyzed after vaccines, government says, quote, all in their head, unquote. Mm-hmm. So I encourage folks to go out to the Pandemic Response Project news page and read the article. I'm not going to try to cover it in detail here at the end of the show today, but
okay.
It's really disturbing to see, but perhaps sadly not all that surprising to see an attempt to muddy the picture here or cover up the problem rather than a upfront acknowledgement that mistakes were made, that the problems need to be addressed, that the children need to get the best medical care and attention they can to deal with these problems, to try and ameliorate or cure and heal these children, and compensate in whatever way best could be done these children and their families for this horrible tragedy that has befallen them.
Right. I think it sounds like a trend that there are people, organizations, groups, or industry, whatever, that, as you say, rewrite history. They put the new spin on it so that pretty soon, you know, if they say something enough times, people are going to believe it without trusting their own observation and the facts of what has been recorded. And this is very frightening, really, that we are moving in such a direction that truth and, as you say, justice to compensate these people are trying to be put into a different direction, that we're not getting the truth anymore.
That this is anything new, as I think maybe you're implying there, whether intentionally or not. The more I see evidence of this kind of manipulation, and I see it more, and the more you look beneath the surface, the more you're going to find it. At least that's my experience. I'm not sure how long this has been the general modus operandi of the mainstream media, pharmaceutical industry, other industries and entities. I don't know. I don't know how far-reaching it is in its scope presently or in its application looking backwards in time. But it certainly is happening. It's something we need to pay attention to because there are rapid changes happening on multiple levels in our country. We are moving in a direction of less and less freedom, more and more control, decision-making authority being pushed up the ladder, where fewer and fewer people having more and more power and authority over more and more people. And it's quite disturbing. We have mentioned in the past, if I can squeeze in one more here, because I just feel like this is such an important one. There was at 4 years in the making, according to this article, that there's now a global treaty to internationally to remove mercury
from
many different products, and yet a narrow, small category of exemptions to this ban, global ban on mercury. I mean, it's such a validation for what people, research scientists have been saying for decades about the problems of mercury and its toxicity and its impact and so forth. But I guess I can't say surprisingly, Debbie, but to my great, great disappointment, vaccines are a notable, probably the most notable exemption to this global ban. And I just can't help but feel cynical about this, that of course they're not going to ban mercury from vaccines, because if they did that, the chronic disease rates would dramatically improve. We would see clearer evidence, and I think there's already pretty clear evidence, but we'd see even more clear evidence about the relationship between the mercury vaccines and chronic disease in children and others. I don't know if this is some evil plan to keep hurting people and profiting from it, or if it's just one of those slippery slope things that got out of control. It's sort of like if you discover a problem that you didn't know was there, you know, you have two choices. You try to hide it so you don't get called on it, or you be right up front and deal with it and get it over with and get on with your life. And if you don't, if you choose the first one there, that you cover it, well, the longer you cover something up, the bigger it is, the thing that you're covering up. And we've talked about the evidence that the Coalition for Mercury-Free Drugs got through the Freedom of Information Act that showed that CDC officials know that mercury causes autism. But the longer they hide that fact from the public, the more explosive it's going to be when they finally reveal it, or when it finally gets revealed. You know, the mature and ethical and moral and honorable way to deal with a serious problem is you acknowledge it right up front, because that's when it's going to be the smallest and easiest to deal with, and that's the way to do so with integrity. And we're not talking just abstract concepts here. In this case, the integrity is minimizing unnecessary harm to innocent children all over the world. And that didn't take place. And the longer that this suppression continues, the more enormous the harm, the avoidable harm that occurs, and the more explosive the reaction is going to be when it finally does get revealed. So there are some people who have made profoundly serious errors in judgment, people who I hope will end up serving out long prison sentences for their criminal actions and behavior. But we'll just have to see how this plays out. The information has come out, and there is some effort being made to pursue this formally. So we'll just have to see how it plays out. Of course, I'll report anything I hear about that right here on Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. Debbie, I think I've overstayed my welcome here.
Well, you did talk quite at length about this issue and how you feel about it. I would like to mention that a number of shows ago on the Health In Show, we did have Dr. Isaac Golden, who is works with homeoprophylaxis, and I asked him this question specifically about mercury in the vaccines and the exemption issue. And he explained that it was necessary for the industry to keep the thimerosal and the mercury in the vaccine, especially the flu vaccine, to stabilize it. And until they find or they want to use another mode of stabilizing the vaccine, then this is a necessary component. And that's the underlying rationalization for using it. And so you can understand it when they give you that explanation.
Well, I mean, and I think rationalization is the key word there, because, you know, that assumes the vaccines are necessary and have a net benefit in the first place. Scrutiny of vaccines, careful scrutiny, brings into question in a rather profound way those underlying assumptions. But even if what they said was, you know, we're going to give you a, whatever it might be, 3 or 4 year period to phase the mercury out as you test and develop, you know, other alternatives, based on that rationale, the answer isn't an all or nothing. The answer is we all acknowledge that mercury is bad and needs to be banned wherever possible, so find another answer for vaccines. We certainly have.
Well, they are. They're finding the genetically modified vaccines. So you go from the frying pan into the, what is it, the fire. I don't know. So.
There's any number of potential solutions here. You know, we acknowledge that mercury is a problem. Even if they say that, even if it's only temporarily, we have to keep the mercury in vaccines. Well, okay, then allow people, as a matter of law, to use the homeoprophylaxis option or other options for protecting themselves until the mercury is out of vaccines. This idea that we're just going to flat out exempt vaccines because they're too big to fail is not appropriate. The too big to fail was not appropriate anywhere else. It's been applied in this country. It's like saying these people are above the law. There are people who did not even get a slap on the wrist who should have been in prison for crimes they committed, but because they were part of the banking system was considered to be too big to fail. Well, I mean, that's what's going on here with vaccines. You know, it's too big to fail. We're so important and better than everyone else that we get to be exempt from the law or the rules or the truth about mercury. It's not the only option to say, well, there's nothing we can do, so we keep the mercury in and just have a blanket exemption. That's not a morally or ethically or scientifically or any other reasonable standard. It's not an adequate measure of a response to the issue, in my humble but obviously adamant view.
I would definitely say adamant. That is absolutely true.
Okay.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show. As usual, very educational. We get a little touch of the law from your wisdom and your total involvement in this area and speaking to so many people. Recently, you have gotten many, many inquiries and calls for assistance. I'm sure you've been doing lots of writing and talks, education to hospitals or other legal groups. And I guess the country must applaud you and thank you for all that you have been doing. And I certainly do, because I learn from you every week. So next week we're going to start maybe a new format. At least sometime in the future we will be starting a new format. It will be the 2-hour show, and you're going to start it off, right?
Yeah, tentatively. So this is to be confirmed, but we are tentatively in agreement with merging Homeopathy World Communities, Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Freedomizer Radio, where we'll be broadcasting to both the Homeopathy World community audience and Freedomizer Radio audience. And this will be a total of 2 hours that will really be a mixture of Vaccines and Your Rights, and then finishing up with Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community, talking to you in the last half hour of that 2-hour segment about homeopathy. So we have a tentative agreement to do this. It would be, I believe, from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern time in the afternoon. But these are tentative arrangements, and we may be starting as early as next week, folks. So do pay attention. Debbie, of course, will send out an announcement to Homeopathy World Community listeners, and I'll certainly be posting information on Facebook and Yahoo groups and the like when we confirm all of this. But we're very excited to be looking at combining audiences and shows and going out to even more people to do what we can to address your questions and concerns about vaccines and your rights in the U.S. and to share the ongoing flood, it seems, in recent months of vaccination news.
Right. Okay. Well, happy January. It's on its way out, and we'll see you in February. And I think I'm just going to go ahead and just keep talking for a little while and end the show whenever I'm done talking. we're going to learn about some continuing education with homeopathy, the principles and art of cure by homeopathy by Herbert A. Roberts, M.D. So we'll see you next week, Alan, and take care.
You too, Debbie. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. All right, so last week I was reading chapter, I believe it was 13, called The Dose, and I got about halfway through when the time ran out, so I probably should just start right over from the beginning again to make it a complete thought. And it's he's talking, Dr. Herbert Roberts is basically teaching new students of homeopathy, people who are interested, people in the medical field, and just giving inspiration and direction for how to understand the use of homeopathy, all the way from just a basic introduction of this form of medicine, plus theory, philosophy, understanding the planet, understanding the universe and the relationship of medicine, drugs to individuals who are both healthy and not well. And so here he's talking about the dose. And this is what we call potentization or potency or posology in homeopathy. And it's more with management. How do you know what strength or vibration or resonance of the drug to use? And so he says, in considering the amount of medicine to be used at one time, or to answer the query, what constitutes a dose? It is very important to have some concept of the history of homeopathy, for this throws light upon the development of the problem of dosage. So when you go to a homeopath, they have a multitude of different methods of giving you your medicine. You might get a dry pellet of whatever potentization, whether it is a 6X, 6C, 30C, 200C, 1M, 10M, those are different levels of potentization. Whether they tell you to take it dry sublingually under the tongue, whether you get one dose or you get one in the morning, one at noon, and one at night, whether you repeat it every day, every week, every fortnight, or the possibility of taking liquid drops or diluting it in a glass of water or a quarter of a glass of water. I mean, there are many, many ways that a homeopath will instruct you specifically to take the dose. And the beauty of homeopathy is the finesse and fine-tuning of this energetic resonance with you as an individual. So if you feel that you are getting a lift in your energy by taking your dose, then you don't need to repeat it. But once you feel that energetic lift fade, you might then recognize in yourself that, yes, you need it once a day or once every other day or once a week. So this is the beauty of homeopathy, the ability to make it personalized for you. And Dr. Roberts says, before Hahnemann's time, and indeed in his early work, the dose played an important part. Nothing but crude and massive doses had ever been used in the case of the sick. All physicians used these massive doses as a matter of course, and Hahnemann, being a product of the best training of that day, followed in his early career in the footsteps of his predecessors. So it's precedence, just like in the law. This is how it's always been done. This is how we continue to do it. Even after Hahnemann began to see the light of the law of cure, which was spoken about in previous radio shows, he continued to use massive doses. And it is to be remembered that he made cures with massive doses of crude medicine. But from that, he was obtaining continual experiments. He found that he was obtaining drug effects oftener than he was making a successful cure. So if you take an evaluation of how you're doing with your medicinal treatments, then you need to be an objective person and assess what is truly working and what is not. And this goes for the vaccine issue. If you're seeing so many side effects and so many adverse reactions, then something is wrong in the procedure of this treatment. And that's why in America, at least, they have the vaccine adverse effects organization and place where you can reporting that area of government so that we can document what's going on and make changes. So now Dr. Herbert Roberts says when he became convinced of this, that he was making less cures and more problems, he reduced the dose, dividing and again dividing the dose, watching closely the results. He soon found that the smaller the dose, the more beneficent the results. His experiments with the divided dose did not come until after he had discovered the dynamic action of disease. So disease changes, and we're learning that more and more. Scientists, researchers, the medical field, everybody knows that disease is not just one thing everlasting the same, but it changes with the pressures of the environment. Then, with this logical mind, he must of necessity have correlated his results from the larger doses and brought his ideas of dosage into correlation with the same concept. For if disease be dynamic in nature, the use of the remedy to cure or even to reach the disease must also be dynamic, rather than physiological in form and power. So it's just not a material dose. This is it. You take this aspirin, you know, once a day, or take two aspirin, or whatever it is to take care of the illness or the headache. But rather, it is knowing that the disease is constantly changing. What kind of energy or similar form of medicine could help to alleviate the problem? You need to have a dynamic dose, a dynamic energy that also changes. So let's see what he says. The more Hahnemann became convinced of the dynamic nature of disease, the more he sought the dynamic plane in medicine. And the more he sought the beneficial he found the administration of the Similia. Very, very gradually, the minimum dose, which is always a flexible measure, became even smaller and smaller until it has developed into the infinitesimal. And this is where people, skeptics today, have their greatest problem, because they can't see it, they can't test it, although today's quantum mechanics, we can see changes in many signs and symptoms or many recording devices, rather, that it became so small in size that it became dynamic. Dr. Roberts says, however, it has been a long road to the use of minimum dose, and many animosities have developed, all because of the failure of many minds to grasp the idea of the dynamic nature of disease and the natural tendency to look upon material substance as the remedy and the pathological state as the disease, and the failure to see the expression of disease states in subjective symptoms. And in homeopathy, we use the subjective symptoms. We use what the person communicates to us in body language, in verbal language, in their emotions, in their what they say and communicate, they feel internally or in their mental state. And this is a very difficult thing, because it may not be measurable as a quantity in a lab, in a petri dish, or as a blood test, or a heart rate or pulse. But it's actually, those things are important and they are dynamic. They do change, and you can look at those, but that's not what you use as a homeopath to make your similimum remedy choice. Dr. Roberts says, the gradual recognition of the power of the minimum dose is manifest even in the dominant school of medicine and is being proven in the laboratories of modern science. As a result, gradually lessening doses are being adopted by many who have formerly derided the possibility of effectiveness from small doses. And we are seeing this more and more in our medicines today. You can just imagine the hormone treatments, the replacement hormone pills, how they have cut back from 30 years ago. They have continually divided the doses until they're smaller and smaller and become a little bit more effective. But they still are in somewhat of a crude form, and they're not completely and wholly dynamic in the homeopathic sense, because they might have reduced the dose, but they have not potentized it, which is a very important part of the homeopathic medicine, meaning that it is succussed and shaken and diluted in the process of making the remedy. Many of the leading pharmacies have followed this road in preparing drugs for the use of the general physician. This trend is manifest in the colloidal preparations and the ductless gland therapy. Of late, the physiologist has shown the power of vitamins, and as a particular instance, we might point to recent experiments with vitamin D. And I'm going to emphasize that vitamin D is what all of the alternative healthcare professionals today are saying is going to be your best preventative for influenza. It has been found that one part of the crystalline form to 3/1,000,000,000 has a curative action on rachitis, while one part to 50,000 has a destructive action to the point of causing rickets. This again verifies Hahnemann's dictum on the power of the small dose and the harmful effects of the more material dosage, although this proven material would be classed as infinitesimal by many. This also demonstrates the Arndt Schultz law of action and reaction. So we are coming to a point where we fully recognize and comprehend the soundness of Hahnemann's deductions. Let us go to Hahnemann's Organon. And the Organon of Medicine is the foundation book, written literature from Samuel Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy. And he's reading now from the 5th American edition, for his teaching in regard to the dose. And remember that he did write a 6th edition, which many of the contemporary homeopaths use today, remembering that in every edition this was plainly taught, each edition progressed one step further in the development of the minuteness of the dose. So we call this, in homeopathic speak, we call this the minimum dose. What is the smallest quantity that will cause an effect? In paragraph 112 of the Organon of Medicine, Hahnemann states, "In older descriptions of the fatal effects of overdoses of medicines, it is often to be noticed that the close of such deplorable accidents was marked by certain effects, which were of very different nature from those witnessed at the beginning of the case. These symptoms, which are called forth in opposition to the primary effect or actual operation of the drugs upon the vital force of the organism, are its counter effect or after effect." Now, you know, I'm interjecting here that, you know, you take an antihistamine and you spray that up your nose to unclog yourself and get uncongested from the swelling in your nasal passages. And if you use that kind of a nose drop or spray too often, then you're going to get what's called rebound, and it's going to come back worse than it began. I think he, in this case, in paragraph 112, is talking about something wholly different. He's saying that you're going to get even completely different symptoms than the ones that you started out with. And what perhaps we might call these today would be side effects, but they are really truly effects of the drug because they are not in alignment with the individual. So he is saying the symptoms which are called forth in opposition to the primary effect, and this is part of the theoretical nature of homeopathy, that there is a primary and a secondary effect, one that forces the body into action, and then the secondary effect is the body, that reaction of the immune system, or actual operation of the drugs upon the vital force of the organism, are its counter effect or after effect. But these are rarely, if ever, perceived after moderate doses administered to healthy persons for the purpose of experiment. So here he's talking about provings. To understand, it's like a clinical trial that you give a moderate dose to a healthy person for the purpose of experiment to see what is this drug or medicine going to do to the body if the person is well. They are altogether absent. So you say, he says, you can see them in a moderate dose, but the after effects are altogether absent after minute doses. During the homeopathic curative process, the living organism exhibits only that degree of counteraction against these minute doses, which is required to reestablish the natural state of health. So you can think about making those adjustments, like let's say you're walking on a tight wire and high above the earth, and you've got your arms out to help you balance, and you're constantly making adjustments to your body to stabilize yourself and be able to stand upright and not fall off of that wire. And thus he's saying here that when you give the minute dose, your body has to make the adjustment in its vital force to return to a state of normalcy. Now he's talking about paragraph number 128. The most recent experiments have taught that crude medicinal substances will disclose the same wealth of latent powers as when they are taken in a highly attenuated state. Potentiated by means of trituration and succussion. So I mentioned this earlier, that in order to attenuate, make this a dynamic medicine, you've got to grind it or triturate it and succussion or shake it. Through this simple process, the powers hidden and dormant, as it were in the crude drug, are developed and called into activity in an incredible degree. So this is kind of like the process and procedure for creating a medicated homeopathic dose for that will be dynamic in nature. Number 156, aphorism 156 states, there is, however, scarcely a homeopathic remedy which, though well selected, if not sufficiently reduced in its dose, might not call forth at least one unusual sensation or slight new symptom during its operation on very susceptible and sensitive patients. So here we have an important note that there are individuals out there who are highly sensitive to any kind of drug or any kind of assault on the body or change or asking the dynamic relation of the body to change or their vital force to change. Thus, we see in out there today those people who are highly sensitive to peanuts. Even you cannot open a bag of peanuts at the front of the plane if the child in the back of the plane is so highly sensitive that they're responding to it. And thus we see how a drug can have a minimum dose in that situation. Because whoever in their right mind would think that in the space of a plane, you could simply not even eat it, not even touch it, but yet just open the package and the person will have an allergic response. In the same way, he's saying that the body that is so susceptible and sensitive will have a an adjustment to reattune or have unusual sensations when given really a very low potentized dose that wasn't sufficiently reduced in its dose that it might not call forth some kind of response. So that's the beauty, again, of homeopathy, that you can constantly make these adjustments for the sensitive individual. An aphorism number 157, although a homeopathically selected remedy, by virtue of its fitness and minuteness of dose, quietly cancels or extinguishes an analogous disease, aggravation caused by larger doses may last for several hours. But in reality, these are only drug effects somewhat superior in intensity and very similar to the original disease. So these are intensifications, these aggravations from taking a homeopathic remedy. They last a short while, he's saying several hours, maybe a day, maybe a couple of days. If you've given a homeopathic remedy that is attuned and in resonance with the individual, that is not the minimum dose for that individual. And therefore, the dose is too strong for the individual. And remember, we're reading right now from the edition number 5, where he was using dry doses of pellets rather than using the water doses, which can be far more fine-tuned and far more dynamic in nature when using the water potencies from the 6th edition of the Organon of Medicine. Aphorism number 159. The smaller the dose of the homeopathic remedy, so much the smaller and shorter is the apparent aggravation of the disease during the first hour. Therefore, it seems like he's expecting to see that you give the patient the dose, the homeopathic remedy, and within an hour, you're going to see a response from the vital force, from the person's immune system. And he's telling you that the smaller and shorter is the apparent aggravation or intensity of the symptoms that the patient already has, not calling upon or calling up new symptoms, which the crude dose will do, but in the homeopathic dosage, you're going to get maybe an intensity. Maybe the fever will go up. Maybe the cough will be a little bit more. Maybe the pains will be slightly intensified, yet that is going to be short-lived. And the smaller the dose of the homeopathic remedy, so much the smaller and shorter is the apparent aggravation. And that, he says, within the first hour. Aphorism number 160. He says, the dose of a homeopathic remedy can scarcely be reduced to such a degree of minuteness as to make it powerless to overcome and to completely cure an analogous natural disease of recent origin and undisturbed by injudicious treatment. So here he's telling us that if you have a bullseye and you have a target and you hit the target right in the bullseye and say, this remedy is right on spot, you have selected something that is going to be sensitive to that individual, then he says you can scarcely reduce to such a degree of minuteness as to make it powerless to overcome and completely cure an analogous natural disease of recent origin, meaning that if this is a new disease, an acute disease, not a chronic disease, and it just appeared, then when you have a well-selected remedy, you're obviously going to completely cure it and undisturbed by injudicious treatment. So we may therefore readily understand why a less minute dose of a suitable homeopathic remedy medicine an hour after its exhibition may produce an appreciable homeopathic aggravation of this kind. So he says you're going to be shaking up that vital force, shaking up that body and that immune system in order for, you know, you think about a dog coming out of the water and they shake off all of that moisture and until they get to a dry state on land. And so here you're getting the remedy and the body shaking it up until it will throw off the things that are not normal or the disease state of being and back into the state of normalcy. In Hahnemann's Chronic Diseases, it's another book that he has written, he was equally emphatic when he says, "But when these aggravated original symptoms appear later on in the same strength as at the beginning, or even more strongly later on, this is a sign that the dose of this anti-psoric remedy, although it was correctly selected, was too great and caused the fear that no cure would be effected through it, since medicines given in so large a dose are able to establish a disease which in some respects is similar, but even greater and more troublesome without extinguishing the old disease." Here he's saying if you give a medicine in so large a dose, it's going to actually establish a brand new disease on top of whatever disease was originally there that could be even more troublesome and more great, and you still have the underlying old disease there, which is what a crude drug dose will do. This is caused by the fact that the medicine used in so large a dose unfolds also its other symptoms, which nullify its similarity and thus establishes another dissimilar disease, also chronic, in place of the former. So here you've got an individual that has heart disease or diabetes or arthritis, whatever the chronic disease is, and you give a dose that is way too strong. It's way too strong, and therefore you're going to end up imposing on the individual all of the medicinal effects onto that individual once they start to make that aggravation. It's actually not an aggravation, I don't think. It's probably called something else. When these aggravated original symptoms appear later on in the same strength as at the beginning, he says, or even more strongly later on, this is a sign that the dose of this anti-psoric remedy, although it was correctly selected, was too great. So you don't want to keep giving the dose, even though it was well selected, to the person, because that I think we might call approving of these drugs. I'm not exactly clear in this writing of the chronic diseases whether he's talking about crude drugs or homeopathic drugs. I assume it is maybe, yes, the person needed mercury, but they needed mercury in a potentized form and not in a crude form. And therefore, you're just going to complicate the disease by adding this crude drug of mercury on top of it. Yeah, you're going to get rid of some of the symptoms, but on top of it, you're going to create a whole new set of symptoms and a whole new chronic disease. Hahnemann says, this, the large dose of medicine, finds its decision already in the 16th, 18th, or 20th day of the effect of the medicine given in too large a dose. So he says, you know, between 2 to 2 weeks to a month, you're going to see these effects, as it must then be checked, either by prescribing its antidote, or when this is not known, by giving another anti-psoric medicine as suitable as possible to the symptoms then prevailing. So here he's saying, retake this case, see the person now not only has not gotten rid of their original chronic disease, now they have this whole other set of symptoms. Now you have to retake the case and do it for the new symptoms so that you can antidote whatever it is that was given that was too much. And this in a very moderate dose. And when this is not yet sufficient for abolishing this sinister medicinal disease, by prescribing a second medicine as suitable as possible at that time, which means that you don't wait, you want to eliminate this secondary layer of disease on top of it, and you either get a response right away or you go to the next remedy that is most suitable. When the stormy assault of the excessive dose of even a correctly selected remedy, homeopathic remedy, has been assuaged by the following use of an antidote or the later use of some other anti-psoric remedy, this remedy, which had only proved injurious through its excessive strength, may again be used. And indeed, as it is homeopathically indicated, with the best success, only in a far smaller dose and in a far more highly potentized attenuation. So, okay, you did good. You made a good selection. You picked the right remedy, but it was given in too strong of a form, and then the person responded negatively. They responded with aggravations. They responded with new symptoms. So now you have to either antidote, which he says antidote this with one of the remedies that are listed in the homeopathic books, or by coffee or by camphor or whatever way that you antidote the remedy. Then he says once that is handled, then you can go back again with the correct selected remedy, which you did originally choose, but you need to give it homeopathically in a higher potentized form, which would be more dynamic and less hypersensitized to that individual. And still again, he says, no harm will be done if the dose given is even smaller than I have indicated. It can hardly be too small, if only everything is avoided that might interfere with the action of the medicine or obstruct it. They will even then do everything of good that can in general be expected of medicine, if only the antipsoriatic was selected correctly in all respects as to the carefully examined symptoms of the disease and was thus homeopathic. And the patient did not, by his actions, disturb the medicine of his action. So today we think about going to the dentist. Dentistry can change the dynamics in the individual and have an effect. Going under power lines might have an effect in the energetic body, the electric energetic body. Taking drugs, taking opium, taking coffee and camphor, as mentioned before, these aromatics can disturb the body. So he's saying if you're not, or let's say having a shock and maybe somebody passed away or there was an accident, that's an impression on the body that might throw the body into another state of being. So unless the action is disturbed by something, then no matter how small the dose of the correctly given remedy in the potentized form, this will have a positive action. On the other hand, we have the great advantage that even if in some case the selection should not have been made quite suitably, we have the great advantage that we can easily put out of action the wrong medicine in its minimal dose in the manner indicated above, when the treatment can be continued with a suitable antipsoriatic without delay. So he says we can correct any kind of not properly selected or not perfectly selected remedy, because some remedies are similar, but they're not similar. They're not completely on target. They're within range and will cause some action by the body, but they won't be so perfectly on target, so then you can retake the case and make these corrections. Dr. Roberts says, if prescribers in general, and especially those starting on the path of homeopathic prescribing, would take special note of this warning, they would save themselves much trouble and their patients much needless suffering. Hahnemann felt the waste of time, effort, and actual suffering needlessly caused when he cried, and quoting from Hahnemann, what would they have risked if they had at once heeded my words and had first made use of the small dose? Could anything worse have happened than that these small doses might have proved ineffectual? They could not have injured anybody, but in their unintelligent, self-willed use of large doses in homeopathic practice, they only passed again through the same roundabout route so dangerous to their patients, which I, in order to save them the trouble, had already passed through with trembling, but successfully, and after doing much mischief and having wasted much time, they had eventually, if they wanted to cure, to arrive at the only correct goal, which I had made known to them long before, faithfully and openly giving to them the reasons therefor. Thus, as a parent might say to a child, I've already lived my life. I have this experience. I'm passing it on to you. Just take my word for it. Do it this way, and things will turn out right. And he's saying, why don't they listen to me, these unintelligent, self-willed use of large doses in homeopathic practice? So he's telling you, look, I've already wasted enough time. I have done this. I have had successes. I've had failures. This is the way to do it. Then Dr. Roberts says that Boninghausen also passed through this roundabout route is witnessed by his words in his lesser writing, quoting from an earlier statement in the book Homeopathy, A Reader for the Cultivated Non-Medical Public. He says, quote, since I also, led by the almost unanimous assertions as to the untenableness of this teaching, gave, though only for a short time, large doses and with bad success, unquote. Homeopathic dosage is based upon law, as is the selection of the remedy based upon the law of similars. Action and reaction are equal and opposite. This is fundamental, and it is this law that must guide us in the application of drugs. The so-called primary action of drugs and the so-called secondary action of drugs are manifest to any observer. As a common illustration, we may take the nausea and vomiting of ipecacuanha. Yet, in small doses, it is curative in sickness with nausea and vomiting as prominent symptoms. Other symptoms agreeing. Opium causes profound sleep when used in the ordinary manner. Yet opium is of inestimable value when given homeopathically in small doses in cases of profound coma. These instances cited are of drugs classic in massive doses, or in common parlance, physiological doses for certain common states of sickness. So we understand that opium and ipecac are used classically as crude substances in massive doses for the physiological level, for the pathological level, for the material level, whereas opium and ipecac given homeopathically are reaching far into the dynamic, energetic level of healing. The physiological action of a drug, however, has nothing whatever to do with the curative action from the homeopathic point of view, because homeopathic remedies are never used in physiological doses. This may seem at first illogical because we may use them in low potencies, yet we never use them for their physiologic effect. The physiologic action is toxic in nature, therefore injurious to the patient. The physiologic action of a drug is not its therapeutic or curative action. It is the exact opposite of a curative action, and it is never employed in homeopathic practice for curative effects. The use of the drug for physiological form is an acknowledgement of the attempt to produce drug symptoms because of their primary action, and an acknowledgement also that the physician so using the drug has never observed the secondary symptoms. Speaking of narcotic drugs, in paragraph 113 of Hahnemann's Organon, he says, as these narcotic drugs destroy sensibility and sensation, as well as irritability, in their primary effect, a heightened state both of sensibility and irritability is frequently observed in healthy persons. That's the proving, as an after effect following the administration of narcotics, even in moderate doses, unquote, Hahnemann's Organon, paragraph 113. Pathogenic is the term used by the homeopathic physicians as a more correct term for the primary symptoms produced by the drug, and as a synonym for the term toxic. Pathogenic, toxic. In other words, symptoms may be produced by massive doses or by crude drugs, but these symptoms are pathogenic, not curative. These symptoms may show forth family likenesses, as many members of a family under certain circumstances will often have a similar general reaction. But to apply our knowledge of the drug as a curative measure, we must know definitely what its capabilities are.
these capabilities cannot be manifest from the pathogenic symptoms. The homeopathic cure is produced without drug effects. It is accomplished without suffering. It is mild. It is developed through growth. It is dynamic in nature. Therefore, it must be given on the dynamic plane and never in a way to produce drug effects. It, therefore, must be the minimum amount of the drug that will act upon the vital force, which, as Hahnemann says, can scarcely be too small. We must remember, in the dividing of the dose, no matter how far this is extended, there is something of the drug left. Matter is never destroyed. It may be changed in potentization, but an absolute zero is never reached. This does remind me that when I was in high school, we had a conundrum, a puzzle from, I think it was a math teacher, that said, there is the doorway, there is the threshold of the door, and you're standing in front of the door, and I want you to take a half of a step. When will you reach the door? When will you reach the door if you continually take a half a step to get through and walk through the door? Now, put that puzzle and conundrum into your mind. No matter how much you divide the dose by half, by half, by half, by half, infinitesimally, will you ever destroy the drug? Homeopathic dosages require that no new symptoms shall be produced as a result of their administration, for these would be drug effects. But we may find a slight aggravation of the symptoms already present immediately following the administration of the homeopathic remedy, which soon recedes, and improvement continues. So he says, you might expect to see an aggravation which would be an intensity of the symptoms that the patient already has. Not something new, just an intensity. And then you will soon see that recedes and improvement continues. Only the single remedy in the smallest possible dose will usher in these happy results in this way. The suffering is quickly reduced. The strength is conserved. The patient is in a state of restored health. We must not think that the infinitesimal dose cannot produce symptoms. This is frequently found in very susceptible patients. In fact, the best provings are obtained with the high potencies on susceptible people. And, you know, there's only a few minutes left to the show, and I'm trying to move very, very quickly through this. I don't know whether we'll have enough time. When the homeopathic drug is administered, it is so similar to the natural disease that it therefore meets with no resistance, because the sphere of its action is already invaded by a similar disease, and it's resistant overcome by the similar acting disease-producing agent. The affected organs and tissues are open to attack. Susceptibility to the similar remedy is therefore greatly increased. The homeopathic remedy acts upon the identical tracts involved in disease states in a similar way to the disease-producing cause. In order that the suffering and distress may not be increased, it is therefore necessary to use only the smallest possible dose. For this reason, the homeopathic dose is always short of the physiological or pathogenic dose. It must be so small as not to produce too much aggravation for the symptoms already present, and never large enough to produce new symptoms. And here I think a metaphor for this would be, you have a runaway train or a runaway horse, and the rider is riding on the horse, and it's galloping away, and it's totally out of control, as if the disease is upon it, and it is taking its own path, and you are there on your own horse, and you are riding the dynamic horse of the remedy. And what do you do to bring this horse back into a calm, controlled pace, into its proper state of being? You ride up to it quickly, and then you match the pace of the runaway horse in order to slowly slow it down. You certainly wouldn't jerk it backward, because that would produce injury. You certainly wouldn't go so far ahead of it to
maybe you might go a little bit ahead of it, but then you still have to slow down to match its pace because you don't want to jolt it. And in the same way, the homeopathic remedy is matching the potency. And so I don't know whether we're going to keep going with this. I will try and finish a little bit more. There is the law of dosage as well as the law of cure. And when we use a homeopathic remedy, it should be based upon that law. For if homeopathy means anything, it is that it is based upon natural law and order. This law is fixed and unchangeable. It makes no difference with the law if we do not follow it. But it does make a difference with our results. The quantity of action necessary to effect any change in nature is the least possible. The decisive amount is always a minimum, an infinitesimal. It can hardly fail to be plain that the same power which establishes the curative relationship between drugs and disease and regulates this law should at the same time and in the same manner determine the quantity and method of this administration. This places it not upon a notion or a whim of what strength shall be used, but upon our interpretation of the law. And, you know, I'm going to end here with this word, the law, interpretation of the law. I'm going to repeat that one more time. It can hardly fail to be plain with the same power which establishes the curative relationship between drugs and diseases and regulates this law should at the same time and in the same manner determine the quantity and method of this administration. Boy, it sounds like a legal court case or something. It sounds like vaccinations and your rights in America. And there are immutable laws. This places it not upon a notion, not upon a whim of what strength shall be used, but upon our interpretation of the law. So you know what? Force is not an answer. Gentle, acting, infinitesimal, minimum dose will effect a change in nature with the least possible aggravation. How beautiful is that. And I did not finish the end of this chapter 13. I will have to pick it up on the next session because our time is up. And I'll just head out.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Think of us together, like people everywhere. We dream about a world that works, where people really care. Our paths now lie before us, our journeys can be begin. So they do what we bring us, the wisdom from our souls to shine, reaching for the great new love and healing for mankind. Share your light, let your love be unfurled. One by one, we are changing the world. Never go.